And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Thanks, Eric. Good morning and welcome. And thank you for joining us this morning. As always, on Fridays during the legislative session, we're broadcasting live from the State House. And today we'll speak with, we've got a whole lineup of legislators and business representatives. We have David Sharp, who's the chair of the House Education Committee, and he'll be joining us in just a second. We'll have Ann Cummings, chair of the Senate Education Committee, because education and the budget are the two things that are hot topics at the State House. Then we'll have Jane Kitchell. She's the chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, and Bob Helms, who's a Republican member of the House Appropriations Committee. And ending the show today, we'll have a Vermont representative for the National Federation of Independent Business, Chris Jolin, who will be joining us to talk about his perspective of what's happening here at the State House. But first up, David Sharp, chair of the House Education Committee. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Mike. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Act 46 has been in the news lately, and especially the area of caps. Where are you with the discussion about revisions to Act 46, specifically the caps?
So thanks for that question. I'm going to back up, though, and talk about the Act 46 larger school districts. It's been that's been in the news big time this last few weeks. We had a vote in Rutland that was just astounding. Rutland Northeast Supervisory Union that's creating a side-by-side, so protecting two tuition towns, Clarendon and Mendon, and joining the operating schools in a single school district. And it's the vote was unbelievably lopsided, 4-1 in favor of forming that larger school district. I think the public more and more is understanding the value of moving to these larger integrated school districts. The process in terms of, you know, there was lots of concern about whether tuitioning towns would be protected, and we've seen that can happen, does happen. We've also seen where some schools have given up tuitioning in order to be part of a larger union. So we've seen protection in both directions, and that's exciting. And we have four additional larger school districts that have applied to the state school board for authorization for a vote. So that's all exciting news. What's getting in the way, what's the hot topic of the day, is the high spending thresholds and the concern that many have expressed to me about the pressures of expenses going up with special ed and pre-K and the healthcare costs, putting undue strain on the budgets, while at the same time we in the House put those thresholds in place because we feel that there is a need for cost containment. We invest $600 million of non-property tax money into the education fund, and we need to see some constraint in the spending of state dollars.
The Senate has a different approach. You're looking at an incremental approach by lifting the caps by a certain percentage. I think it's 0.9% lifting the cap, giving it some more room for health care, those sort of expenditures. The Senate has taken a different approach, which is eliminating the caps. How do you come to agreement there?
Well, it's not easy. I'd have done it a couple of weeks ago if it were easy, and I continue to work on it. I believe there we can get there. The repeal is not acceptable to the House. It simply isn't. We need to see some cost containment, and we're flexible, I think, to a certain extent in how that cost containment goes forward. But to not have cost containment in place is not acceptable.
The interesting thing about Act 46, it was enacted to curb sort of the cost of education, and it was done by consolidation of districts plus the high threshold spending requirements that are in 46. And as a result, the theory is that you would control property taxes. Is it because the Senate has voted to remove the caps? Is it that concern in the House that's driving not removing the caps, keeping the caps in place in order to to meet the needs of the taxpayers that you've heard from?
So if you, yes, it is about meeting the responding to the needs and concerns of taxpayers. If you look at the whole of Act 46 and the move to larger integrated school districts, not only do they save money, but they provide educational opportunities for students that in some areas of the state are just lacking, and our students don't have the opportunities they need to compete in the 21st century. So it's more than just cost savings in the bigger picture of Act 46. To get to these larger school districts, however, takes time. And we do have one that's in place. They expect to save $1 million. We have a number of others, maybe as many as 12, that will be in place by the end of June. That's significant, and those will lead to savings in the out years. But the cost containment provisions in Act 46 were meant as a bridge to get from here to the savings that we can expect in the larger school districts.
Some of the complaints that I've heard from listeners and others is that how can you pass a bill one year and then abandon portions of it the next year? And I understand that you're not speaking for the Senate, you're speaking for the House, but what sort of response would you give, is because you are amending the bill, so what sort of response would you give to those listeners?
Well, when you do such a momentous bill as Act 46, there are going to be tweaks, and before we get done here, there may be some tweaks in how these school districts come together. It's not easy in some areas of the state with the patchwork of different types of school districts that we have. So it doesn't surprise me that we're listening, we're hearing what the feedback from passing Act 46, and responding to that. I think that's a responsible thing for legislators to do.
The Agency of Education admitted that there seemed to have been some wires crossed in terms of interpretation of certain calculations for whether you're over the cap, under the cap. Can you tell me where that is right now?
So we discovered that early on and engaged in conversations with AOE. The language that we used in Act 46, we lifted directly out of 68. So it came as quite a surprise to us that the agency was interpreting calculation for the thresholds differently in Act 46 than in Act 68. So we engaged in conversation with AOE. They came around to understanding legislative intent was to calculate the same way as we did in Act 68, and that then a memo went out that was quite shocking because it only told part of the story and really created a tempest in a teapot, I might say. You know, the actual effect on districts that have no change in their extraordinary expenses, there is no change. It's a different way of calculating it, but there's no change. For districts that had to do a construction project, like put a roof on their building, there was a change, and so it did affect those districts. Or for districts that paid off a bond, it affected them adversely. So the part of what we're moving forward with is a hold harmless provision where you use the calculation that best fits your district.
And you had several proposed amendments yesterday. I think it was in committee that I read about. Can you sort of go over what some of those amendments are that it seemed passed the committee or was an affirmative vote by the committee?
So I'll try to recall them off the top of my head. I don't have notes in front of me. One was to reduce the fine or penalty associated with going over the threshold.
From a dollar to 50 cents or
50
something.
50 cents or 25 cents. Mm-hmm. And one was to do the 0.9. One was to do this hold harmless provision.
That's what I read about, is those.
There were a couple of others, but I don't recall them at the moment.
Let's talk about other things for a minute. What else in your committee are you going to be taking up this year other than Act 46?
Well, if we can find time, and I surely hope we do, I've heard a lot about special education over the years, and we have heard that there are some districts that are doing an excellent job for less money, using some practices that we want to understand better and then maybe spread across the state. There are a couple of school districts that brought in a particular consultant that helped them save a ton of money and get better outcomes for special ed kids. We also have a pilot program going called the SWIFT program that has some promising information, and so we want to look at special ed. I also want to look at technical education, governance, and financing of tech ed. We're going to age out of our workforce a bunch of electricians and plumbers and carpenters and HVAC people, and we don't have adequate training in place to prepare young people for that workforce. Those are good-paying jobs. They don't require a college bachelor's degree. They do require training after high school. So trying to look at, you know, how we operate our tech centers and how we create a pathway for those students to go into those professions after they graduate from their tech centers.
Yesterday, the governor had his budget speech. From an educational standpoint, was there anything in there you liked? Was there anything in there you didn't like?
So I really like the creation of 529 plans. My wife and I have done 529 plans for our three grandchildren already. I don't see college education getting any cheaper over the next couple of decades. And I want my grandchildren to be able to have the college education that I had and that our children had. So we started those for our grandchildren, and I think it's really exciting to put in place some funding for children born today to Vermonters, that they have a start of a savings account so that they can afford college.
Was there anything in there you didn't like?
Not that I recall. The governor's been pretty supportive of education.
Let's sort of, final question. The governor yesterday said that he wanted to expand the provider tax to docs and dentists, to private docs. Doctors who are in private practice and dentists. What's your position on that?
Well, I have been focused for decades on dental care in Vermont. I supervised Vista Volunteers in 1971, who brought a dental clinic to Bristol. The need for dental care in this state is dramatic, and it's pretty hard to interview for a job when you don't have any teeth. I mean, it's just that simple. And so we need to get dental care into the low-income families, particularly children across the state. And in order to have that done, we need to provide a better reimbursement process for dentists. And so I was excited. If that's the result of what the governor's proposing, it has to go through the legislature, and the devil's in the details. But if the result is that we deliver more dental care to Medicaid children, then I think that's fantastic.
David, I know you're busy. I thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
David Sharp, Chair of the House Education Committee, coming up. Ann Cummings, Chair of the Senate Education Committee. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome to Open Mic Ann Cummings, who's the chair of the Senate Education Committee. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning.
I just spoke with David Sharp, who is the chair of the House Education Committee. He said that they're going through the sort of the same things with the caps, the high threshold spending limits that we're talking about in Act 46. And he mentioned that the House is adamant in keeping the caps and letting the threshold rise a little bit instead of eliminating the caps. The Senate has eliminated the caps. Can you give me a little insight of what your thinking was in that?
Our thinking was that the spending thresholds were proposed to the Senate at the last day of the Committee of Conference. We looked at the charts and the numbers, and it made sense that lower spending schools, you know, had more room to grow than higher spending schools. Sounded good. And so we accepted them. But as things played out, it turns out that educational funding is more complicated than that. And we started to hear from a lot of low-spending schools that were getting hit with significant penalties. And we're talking a 2 to 5 cent increase in their tax rates. And so the lower-income towns, the poorer towns, the towns that were doing a really good job were hitting this threshold. And the Senate said, you know, Senate Education, look, we tried. We all want to control the rise in the cost of education and the rise of property taxes. We tried this. It didn't work. It's time to go back to square one, give ourselves time, and work on it. And that's what we've done.
The effort of putting forth Act 46, of course, was to curb the cost of education, especially with to encourage consolidation of districts, and also the higher thresholds to try to curb the spending. What do you say to those Vermonters who say, well, look, we're having this huge growth in our property taxes. If you lighten the requirement, How do you accomplish the goal of giving us some property tax relief in Act 46?
Okay. Act 46, what we did is we looked at what the cost drivers were. Why is the cost of education going up? And it's going up pretty much with the rate of inflation, not necessarily your property tax, because that's a more complicated calculation. But the cost of education's pretty much been rising with inflation. But the number of students are going down. It's counterintuitive. The cost of education should go down as the number of students did. Well, the number of students have, but we are still running schools that used to have 100, and now they've got 50 kids. And that's going to keep declining as an average. It costs the same to run that school, whether you've got 50 or 100. There's a fixed cost. You've got to heat it, light it, transport those kids. And what we came up with is, look, we can't continue to run all these micro schools, some of them. And so we need to have schools start talking together about how can we better organize, how can we get a more efficient system so that we can, you know, do a better job of educating our children, because that's prime. We're hearing right now from employers that they can't hire employees, new employees, with the math skills they need to do today's education. And so to have schools come in and say, well, you know, to stay under the threshold, we've cut everything else. We're cutting math lab, because that's not the actual class. That's the kind of extra help. That's counterintuitive.
Let me ask this, Ann, because if you look throughout the United States, whether it's property tax caps or budget caps in school spending are fairly popular among residents. You look at Massachusetts, they got Proposition 2.5. You look at California, they got Proposition 13. At least from Vermonter's perspective, they look at this and they say, wait a second, don't we need caps? I understand what you're saying, the consolidation, but don't we need caps on spending or property tax?
I think we need to control the cost of education, and we need to control the rise in property taxes. Vermont is unique in how it funds its schools, and so what works in other states doesn't. Every other school state works on an adequacy formula. They don't have the local control that we have. We are a unique state, and so we try and figure out a unique way of dealing with this. There are other things in the property tax formula that we haven't looked at. We're only looking at the actual cost of classroom education. We haven't talked about the High School of Vermont that does education in the prison system. We haven't talked about adult basic ed,
which, by the way, is the largest high school in the state.
It is, which is another issue. We haven't talked about some of those other things that are being funded out of the property tax. We're looking totally at the cost of classroom education. We are going to be looking next at the cost of special ed, which is another cost driver. Those are all long-term. It's taken us 20, 30 years to get here. We're going to work ourselves out. I think the pressure is people are trying to find a way to do an immediate relief. We have that. It's called income sensitivity. I find it interesting that the House has always fought to lower income sensitivity, and the Senate has always fought to raise it or at least hold it stable. That is supposed to be your property tax relief, that you are limited. If you make less than $90,000 a year, you're limited to a percentage of your income you can pay in property tax.
I want to get into other things okay. other than Act 46, but I just have to ask this question because I've had listeners talk about this in that one of the complaints that I've heard from listeners and others is that the legislature passes a bill one year and then the next year repeals parts of it or tries to repeal parts of it. And the question is, what's going on?
I think what's going on is the world has changed. Issues are much more complicated than they were in the olden days when the system was set up. You essentially have a part-time legislature with no staff. We have a group of finance and a group of legislative people. We're here a very short time. And you do your best, but sometimes you don't get it right the first time. And I was always taught if you make a mistake, you fess up and you go back and you try and learn from your mistakes and go forward. But as long as, you know, we have one scheduler, essentially, that works for the committee, and then we share everything else. So it's not a deep or robust system that we have. Everybody works very hard, crazy hours around here towards the end of the session. But sometimes you just don't get it all right.
Next to last question, I promise. Okay. I know your time is you're busy this time of year. What other issues are you going to be taking up this year in your committee?
Okay, my committee really, we are going to be putting out a higher ed bill. Part of our other concern is after we get these kids out of high school, we have one of the highest high school graduation rates and one of the lowest continuation rates. So we are going to be doing a higher ed, looking at the cost of the state colleges, especially higher ed. How do we get more students to go on? And again, we're going to be looking at the whole special ed. How are we dealing with this influx of kids that are showing up for school not ready to learn?
The governor yesterday gave his budget address. Anything in there from an education point of view that struck you regarding his address? Things that you agreed with, things that you disagreed with?
I think the two things he said was these savings accounts, putting some money into that. We passed that last year with the idea of finding a funding source. I think that's a good idea. The big one is the Step Up program. All those folks that are out flipping burgers, making minimum wage, pretty much condemning themselves in the statistic about no high school diploma and ending up in the correction system is pretty frightening. And the idea of actually reaching out to young people where they are and helping them get the support and the counseling they need to get, not necessarily college, but the continuing education to get good jobs.
Anything you didn't like in that budget speech?
Not offhand. I haven't had time to digest all of it. The devil is always in the details.
As always, thank you very much. We've been speaking with Senator Ann Cummings, who's the chair of the Senate Education Committee. Thank you, Ann.
Well, thank you.
Up next, Jane Kitchell, chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome to Open Mic Jane Kitchell, who's the chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee. Good morning, Jane.
Good morning. Great to be here, Mike.
Well, thank you. What does the Appropriations Committee do? You're the chair of the Appropriations Committee. What does it do, and what do you do in particular to set the priorities for the committee?
Well, ultimately, the Appropriations Committee is responsible for presenting to the legislature an annual budget. And from my perspective, it's really where all of state government comes together. And some states, they divvy up budget bills, but in Vermont, we call it the big bill. And I find that that's one of the greatest challenges, but it's also the beauty of it is that if you're on appropriations, you see all the functions of government, you see connecting points that perhaps the people are actually implementing various parts of or administering those parts of government may not see. And ultimately, and I would agree with the governor, that how you allocate your public resources reflects what are the priorities and what are the needs of the state.
The Appropriations Committee, they don't just sort of show up and start. It seems to be pretty much a year-round job, isn't it, in terms of reviewing, because you have budget adjustment. Can you sort of explain that process?
Sure. Every year, the governor proposed a budget, and then it comes to the Appropriations Committee, first to the House, and then they spend several months taking testimony, gathering data, hearing all the different points of view, trying to weigh it out, and then they pass their bill and it comes to the Senate. And then we would do the same. We oftentimes make changes, modifications, and there are differences between what the House may decide and what the Senate would decide, and we'll go to a committee of conference where we iron out those differences. Sometimes the administration proposes either budgetary changes or tax revenues. Appropriations Committee does not do revenues. We're not the tax committee. That is done by Senate Finance. And so the budget the governor proposed yesterday includes two increases, revenue increases, and that would go to the Finance Committee. Now, obviously, those revenues are assumed in the budget that the governor presented to us. So if sometimes we would say we don't want to accept that revenue proposal, then we would either have to find something else or figure out how to make commensurate reductions in the budget. There's no question that historically, actually I use the analogy of Sisyphus pushing the boulder up the hill when it deals with health care costs, which is really Medicaid for us, and that is health care spending increases faster than inflation. Regular inflation, it increases faster than the standard revenue growth and revenue streams that come into the state. So if you have, which is the second largest part of the state budget, if you have that big a part of your budget that grows faster for a variety of reasons, like new pharmaceutical items to more people enrolling to just healthcare services are costing everybody more, then that poses a real constraint on that budget process and how you fund it, because you can close it for 1 year, but unless you deal with those underlying forces that are generating that annual growth at that higher rate, you're just every year, you're like Sisyphus, you balance the budget and then it reopens again. And that's why we've got to look at how we bring healthcare spending more in line with revenue growth, whether it's the state of Vermont or whether it's an employer.
The budget is passed. The governor proposes the budget. It goes to the House, comes to the Senate. It's passed, and then but your duties are not done. I mean, oftentimes you will come in and have to adjust that year's budget. Can you sort of go through that process as well?
Sure. As a matter of fact, that's what the Senate Appropriations is doing right now, and there are a number of areas where this year's budget, when you're building it back. Months ahead, you're using caseload estimates, you're using expenditure estimates, and things can change. So every year we have a budget adjustment, which is sort of truing it up based on actual experience to date within this current fiscal year. And then several days ago, the economists downgraded the revenues available in this fiscal year by $4.7 million or a net of 3.7. So those reductions in revenues have to be accommodated in a balanced budget, and we have to find the savings to offset the revised revenue projection.
Yesterday, the governor did his budget speech. It's an annual event that the governor does, presents his budget to both appropriations committees. You start taking testimony on it. Is there anything in the budget that you liked, anything you didn't like or were concerned about, or anything that's just a non-starter for you?
Well, at this point in the process, I don't really want to say anything is off the table. One thing that we as a legislature have also articulated as a desirable goal is not relying on the use of one-time money. So the fact that we've got a budget that seems to get us to that place is really good news to, I think, all of us. And that has been a source of concern for people over the last few years. Probably not so much in the when we had the Great Recession, because we had all the federal money coming in basically to avoid wrenching and making the reductions that would have been necessary for states to make. And that, to me, was a legitimate use of those federal dollars to preserve, whether it's roads, bridges, or whatever, that or benefit structure. So that was the good news. We're trying to get a better handle on health care. What are the drivers? One of the proposals is something that relates to something I did years ago, and that was the coverage of pregnant women up to a certain level of income. And that was viewed as a way of supporting families outside benefit structure, but it was also a public health and prenatal care. And so the proposal is to move that coverage over to private insurance, but without knowing, are there going to be cost sharing? What will be the premiums? What will be the scope of coverage? I just need to make sure from a health policy perspective, if there's anything that impacts healthy births, it's really prenatal care. So that's one, simply because of my long-term involvement, that I really would like to take a handle, get a better handle on. But just healthcare spending in general, are there more things that can be done? There's a controversial piece, and that's around the involuntary medication. And the Human Services and Health and Welfare Committees have grappled with that, and there's strong opinion around the use. This would be people who are in a very serious mental health episode, and whether medication could be given involuntarily. Some of our healthcare providers feel that some of our mental health spending is higher than it needs to be, simply because of the length of time it takes to get a decision made to provide medication when the patient refuses it.
You've just brought up your background, and your background is intriguing in that you were head of a very large department in the Agency of Human Services. Actually, you were the secretary of the Agency of Human Services, and by far that's the largest agency in state government, by far has the biggest expenditures that go into that agency. From your perspective, Senator John Campbell, the Senate pro tem, had mentioned that maybe we should start looking at how we deliver services, how we maybe can reorganize the agency. Any thoughts in terms of how we can reorganize the agency, how it can become more efficient, and how it may be able to cut some costs?
Well, frankly, I do have a long association with the agency, and I came into state government before the agency was even created in 1971. And over time, the world changes. And at that time, healthcare was a very small part of the agency, which now that healthcare spending has grown, as I mentioned. So it's the second largest area of spending in the state budget. The largest areas are K through 12 system costs. And that it's about $1.7 billion that we're spending on healthcare through Medicaid. And back in when the agency was created, it was really a benefit that was coverage provided to either beneficiaries of public assistance or in nursing homes. And if you look at how the world has changed and the role of the state relative to transforming healthcare delivery, to the way in which Medicaid funding is used, the closing of our institutions, et cetera, I feel that an agency that has the scope of responsibility and constitutes half of state government is really not, in spite of anybody's best efforts and commitment, is really too large to get the level of attention and accountability that we need today. And I think if you look at the related healthcare decisions, some of the issues that are confronting us, we really need to create an agency that focuses on the administration of those healthcare benefits and services, better coordination. I think we need to really create a system of better accountability, and right now it's quite diffuse. On the other hand, there's enormous amount of work to be done on the traditional human services side. If you look at families, you look at children that need protection, to how we're trying to keep people in the community, how we support transition out of a maybe correctional facility, how we work with community partners around the delivery of social services. Are we investing money in the right services and programs for the right outcomes? Tremendous amount of work there, too. And I really feel that this is the time to make that structural change, because what we have or have is a legacy system. We talk about it for IT. We talk about it in, healthcare. We really need to look at how we manage all those services, benefits, and resources. And I feel we would get better oversight and better accountability. And I'm concluding that as someone who held that job. I'm just saying it's just it's really an impossible scope of functions.
One of the things, getting back to the budget, one of the things yesterday that the governor proposed was expanding the provider tax to private practice doctors and dentists. That was done in order for him to be able to balance the budget. He's using Medicaid money to draw down, close the Medicaid gap partly with that tax, and also a tax on mutual funds, an increased tax on mutual funds. I think it goes from $60 now to $100. What's your take on that?
Well, those are two proposals that will have to be taken up first on the Finance Committee. The first on the mutual fund seems to be more, you know, are we out of line relative to other states around us? And the provider tax, the question is, what does that mean directly to those providers? It's no question that we've had an issue with dental access. And is this going to make it worse? What are the complexities associated with it? It's been proposed before and rejected. So I think that is going to be one proposal that would be approached very cautiously in trying to understand what it would be. It would mean a reduction, as it's proposed, on hospitals, and and there are some people that feel that there's greater capacity there than perhaps on some of these individual practicing physicians, and how does that fit relative to our rural nature physician shortage or healthcare shortage. So I would say that that would be one that would be very, very carefully looked at in light of the concerns and the potential collateral impacts that have been identified.
I've got an interesting question. Is it the chicken or egg? Does Finance Committee sort of take your lead in saying this is the money we need, or does Finance Committee say this is what we're looking at, here's the revenue that you have? How does that work?
Well, it means that the chair of finance and the chair of appropriations have to work pretty carefully and closely. So we try to work it out in terms of what we see is reasonable, what we think our committees will support, and so we work across lines. As a matter of fact, that brings up something that we see more and more, and that is so many issues transcend multiple committees, and how we deal with those kinds of policy issues. So in this case, Senator Ash and I will be having a lot of conversations, and we also have them with our House counterparts as well throughout the process.
So he doesn't blame it on you, saying, "Look, they're the ones that are spending. I have to bring up the revenue."
Yeah, but sometimes they say we're not willing to bring up the revenue, and then it does require some negotiation. But it seems to work out pretty well.
Let's talk about some things generally that's swirling around here. That, as a legislator, not necessarily budgetary stuff, but they will perhaps hit your committee. Some of the things that are swirling around here that may or may not appear before your committee. Carbon tax. Where are you on a carbon tax?
I don't. My view is that a carbon tax, Vermont, for us to consider a carbon tax is not realistic. I'm really concerned about the economic impact. The other part is, don't forget, I represent a part of the state that borders New Hampshire. And a lot of our tax policies have much more significant implications depending on where you live in the state, and that would be enormous. We already have concerns about the extent to which Vermont business is lost to those border businesses. So carbon tax, the one thing I would say, Mike, that most people don't, it's just another tax, but as I understand it, it's not to layer it on in terms of on top of everything that exists today, but to look at our basic tax structure and look at whether this should be put into that tax base and something else eliminated. So if there's one area where people are really concerned, it's sort of like you're adding more to what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And that's not how it's designed. But right now, for Vermont to move out ahead, I think the general view in this building is that's not very realistic.
Marijuana, any chance of passing this year?
Oh, boy.
It'll probably come to your committee. Because
yes, it will. It will. After it comes through finance.
And transportation.
Yeah.
Because and you sit on transportation.
I do. And the big concern is around impaired driving. And that is, I think, a fairly broad concern on the part of Vermonters. I've talked to states that have the legalization, which, in their case, actually the voters, not the legislature.
It was referendum. Yeah.
It was referendum. It wasn't their legislature that passed it. It was voters. And so what you have to have are law enforcement who have training. I think that if it comes to out of all those committees and ends up in appropriations, I would say that we would have an obligation to make sure that the revenues that are anticipated get directed toward prevention, toward treatment, toward appropriate law enforcement, and whatever it's necessary to assure the public. I think if that's the road, then there are two areas, obviously public health and public safety are two key concerns. I don't know what's going to happen at this point or what we will have. The Judiciary Committee has just finished some public hearings. I attended the one in St. Johnsbury. I think there's general agreement. If you're going to move forward and the world around us seems to be changing, you do it in a very cautious, very structured, and you make sure that that some of those key concerns are adequately addressed.
Have you taken a position on that?
I haven't yet. Okay. I haven't. Some people say I won't even consider it. I just am opposed to anything. It's a bad message. On the other hand, I have a lot of constituents who feel that right now prohibition isn't working and this would be a better approach. And so I'm trying to be sure I listen to all points of view. And the committee work, in my mind, is so important because that needs to get done. So in terms of saying yes or no or what the bill will look like, sometimes, you know, that can make a big difference. I voted against things that maybe underneath I would have agreed with, but I didn't think the bill was a good one.
One of the things that I've been reading is a brouhaha on ethics commission or an ethics committee or whatever it is. Obviously, the Norm McAllister has brought this issue, the Norm McAllister's suspension has brought this issue to the forefront. What's your position on, I guess it's either an ethics commission or an ethics committee that, what's your position on either?
Well, I think the public wants assurances that we take affirmative action if there is what is viewed as an ethical violation. I think one of the questions is how do you define it, and then what you want to put in for requirements and the extent to which it would have sort of a dampening effect on people's willing to run for public office. If you're asked, there's been some suggestion that there should be a complete financial disclosure, and some people may own their own business, they may have investments and so forth, and they may say, I'm not willing to reveal that much information about my personal circumstances. On the other hand, if you're serving on a board, you're going to be making decisions, that seems to be reasonable. So the question is, what is reasonable and what's the right process to act on it?
We've been talking with Jane Kitchell, who's the chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee. I want to thank you, Jane. I know you're extremely busy, and I thank you for your time.
Well, thank you.
Coming up, a check-in with our friends at Talk Media News, and then Bob Helms, Republican member of the House Appropriations Committee, and Vermont representative for the National Federation of Independent Business, Chris Jolin. This is Open Mic on WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond up in the Kingdom. And, of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. See you in a bit. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Let's go down to what I think is snowy Washington, D.C., and talk to our friends at Talk Media News. On the line is Victoria Jones. Good morning, Victoria.
Good morning. We're waiting. The skies are an ominous, dirty white. It is that, I'm sure you're all very familiar with this, that stillness. You know, and quietness that you have when you're waiting. And I think it's going to be now about 2 hours before it hits. And then we're expecting blizzard conditions and whiteout and all the nastiness and craziness.
And is everybody sort of hightailed it out of town, the reps? I just saw Congressman Welch walk by, so he's out of town. Are most of the Congress out of town right now?
Yes, most of them have left. And, in fact, the House and the Senate have canceled votes for Monday. And they, I think, a little ambitiously, are saying they're going to have votes on Tuesday. Now, seeing as already 5,000 flights have been canceled between today and tomorrow, that's an awful lot of flights to catch up on Sunday, and that's assuming that things will be doable on Sunday and Monday, and that these members of Congress can scramble or dig their way back into D.C. for a start on Tuesday. So maybe they'll start Tuesday, or maybe they'll have to start Wednesday. I don't know. But the other thing is that the federal government is closing at noon today. telework is also an option for people. The DC Metro, which is the nation's second largest metro system, is closing completely. This is only the second time it's happened in history, for the entire weekend starting this afternoon, and the entire DC bus service is closing down this afternoon. So this city is literally grinding to a halt. States of emergency in DC, Maryland, and Virginia.
Hey, Victoria, just out of curiosity, and I always take you off subject, and I apologize for that.
Oh, but no, I love going off subject.
I read last night the National Review, and in it was its editorial and sort of essay from various conservatives dealing with Donald Trump. It was pretty devastating in terms of that it definitely went after Donald Trump. Has there been any sort of blowback on that in D.C.?
This is a huge story, and in fact, this is really on point. The Republican Party is at war with itself over who's worse, Trump or Cruz. And you've got two factions essentially fighting about this. On the one hand, you've got the conservative intellectuals who are convinced that Trump, who's got a sort of nationalist populism message, is a dire threat to conservatism, and they're the ones who've got the manifesto in National Review to try to stop him, and good luck with that, that's not going to work. And then you've got the Republican lobbyists, the elected officials, and the operatives in D.C., and they're really worried about Ted Cruz. He's a hard right zealot crusader who really believes his message. You see, a lot of people don't think that Trump believes half of what he says, but they know that Cruz believes what he's saying. He's against the political establishment, and they think that he could really cut into their influence and their access. He's also somebody who they frankly hate. He has attacked people. He called Mitch McConnell a liar. He's the one who brought about the government shutdown, essentially, over health care. And they are very worried about him. They also think that he would not bring people to the polls. They think he would only have an appeal in a very small number of states. And they think he would do a lot of damage to the Republican brand.
I was interested in... Obviously, I have said this on this program before. I question Donald Trump's credentials as a conservative, given his background and what he's supported. Obviously, the National Review does as well. But what's interesting to me, both Cruz and Trump seem to have the support of sort of national talk shows, radio talk shows. And I'm curious about that, because National Review was at one time the leading conservative voice out there. So there seems to be a split among conservatives, if I'm reading this right.
I think there is a split among conservatives. I mean, nobody in the Senate, apart from Mike Lee from Utah and sometimes Rand Paul, but not right now because he's running against him, likes him. And nobody likes him. He's not considered a particularly likable guy. And he has not gone about making friends in the Senate. That was not his goal. It's a collegial place. Most people go about forming alliances, making friends. You know, I mean, Hillary Clinton, when she got there, a lot of people thought she'd be very imperious. She didn't. She was very humble. She worked very quietly behind the scenes and set about forging alliances with Republicans. That's what most people do. That's how you get along in the Senate. That's not what Ted Cruz did, and it was noticed. And he doesn't even form alliances with his own party or with other conservatives. People notice this, and they don't like him, and it's sort of coming back to bite him.
Let me sort of switch parties to give equal time here. Is Hillary Clinton real worried now? I mean, she's got Bernie up in New Hampshire by a substantial margin. He's starting to build a lead in Iowa, according to the recent polls. Obviously, she has the fire stop at South Carolina. Is that campaign worrying about Bernie Sanders?
Yes, they are. In particular, Bill Clinton is worried about Bernie Sanders. He feels that they underestimated Bernie Sanders, and he also feels that they that the campaign, and he's making this known in the campaign, he feels that they have focused, and now he's getting involved, that they have focused too much on New Hampshire and Iowa at the expense of the delegate-rich March primary states and states beyond that. These are some of these delegate-rich New Hampshire March primary states. They don't even have anybody on the ground doing the work yet. And he's very worried about this, and he's making it known that he thinks that they're making a big mistake. And he's telling anybody who will listen to him about this.
Hey, Victoria, thank you so much. Please hunker down. Be safe down there during the storm. Appreciate your time. That's Victoria Jones from Talk Media News. Up next, Bob Helms, who's a Republican member of the House Appropriations Committee. We'll talk to him about the governor's budget address and what he does and what he's looking for in the FY17 state budget. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome Bob Helms, who's the representative from my parents' hometown, actually, which is, you're from Castleton, is that right?
I have been from Castleton my whole adult life, but about 5 years ago, we sold our house and bought another one in Fairhaven.
Oh.
So I'm right, I can see Castleton.
You're like Sarah Palin, you can see Russia from your...
it's still my district.
Thank you for joining us. I know how busy the Appropriations Committee is nowadays. Now that you've received the governor's budget, when you get the governor's budget, what happens next?
We start sifting and sorting through the intricacies of the budget, and that gets very complicated and complex, and that separates also the smoke and mirrors from everything, and there is always some of that.
Not when I did it.
No, of course not, no. The Douglas administration didn't do any of that stuff. But where was I? So it's only been, it hadn't been 24 hours
right.
yet, and I'm kind of working things back and forth, and we've got a couple new taxes in there that I cannot appreciate on top of the taxes we've done in the past years, so that's going to be an issue for me. The problem with that is, as you probably know, when the governor builds a budget and sends it to you, and it's dependent on two new taxes, and if that's worth $50 million, then, and you don't want to tax, you've got to find a way to come up with $50 million without taxing. After we've been scraping and scrubbing for years, each year it gets harder, much more difficult. So I don't know where this will come out, but it's not going to be easy. I think in the end, for me anyways, we're going to have to take a good look at Medicaid and how much Medicaid can we afford. Now, the way it's done now is we build a program, and I'm just going to pick some numbers for simple usage. If 10,000 people get on, fine, but it might be 20. And that's what's happening. More people have got on the Medicaid rolls. Increase in the price in the Budget Adjustment Act and now in the 17 budget, and we just don't have the money. And we just here we are again, we're trying to tax our way through it. So we can't do that. We can't continue to do that. We've got to get our programs within an area that we can afford.
You had mentioned that after you heard the governor's budget speech, you're not a fan of this expansion of the provider tax to private. I think I'm hearing you. You're not a fan of this provider tax that would be expanded to private practice doctors and to dentists. Also, a increase in the mutual fund fees. Right. It's basically a tax, but
they're probably coming out of the Shumlin administration. They're the most acceptable taxes I've ever heard of. Mm-hmm. But I still, on top of If we hadn't taxed in 5 years, it'd be one thing. But on top of everything we've already taxed, we just, I don't see any movement to stop trying to tax ourselves out of debt.
Mm-hmm.
And it hasn't worked. And it's not going to work. It just gets worse.
Bob, let's take a call from Morrisville. Don, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Can we return to Gloria Jones' comments for a moment, and then maybe you and your Republican guest can respond to what I'm referring to? She's speaking this morning about how Republicans are really hot at Trump and don't understand the way things are going. To me, if Trump is the Republican nominee and Bernie Sanders is the Democrat nominee, that is a win-win situation for America. Either way, we can't go wrong. We're going to have somebody in the presidency who is going to give Congress the boot in the butt that it has needed for the last 20 years. That's the way I view it. A lifelong Republican, I could vote for either one of these people just because I am so totally fed up with Congress. Mitch McConnell is usually referred to in this household as Mitch McComical because I don't think he's got a clue. And all these people are doing is stonewalling the American people. And frankly, what we have spent on Congress in the last 20 years has been the biggest waste of money this country has ever made. That's the way I see the situation. Maybe I'm all wet, but I'd be interested in what you and your guests have to say about that.
Hey, Don, thank you for your phone call. I've obviously been very critical of Donald Trump, and there's a couple of reasons. One is I think he's pretending to be a conservative. I don't think he is a conservative. He hasn't been. His past hasn't been. And I also don't think his proposals work. I don't think his immigration proposal will work. I didn't like how he went after POW, saying he liked soldiers who weren't caught rather than soldiers that were caught. I didn't like how he went after Megyn Kelly in terms of trying to denigrate her. I didn't like how he went after somebody that was disabled. I didn't like it. And so when, you know, that's my opinion. Obviously, I got the scars on my back from people like yourself and others that have talked about the fact that he will shake things up. I question whether he really will. And the second thing is when what I was mentioning was a article and an editorial in National Review. If you remember, National Review was started when there were basically no conservatives. It was started by Buckley. And that National Review has some status with conservatives throughout the United States. And, you know, William F. Buckley was a lone wolf out there for a long, long time in terms of conservatism. And I think that his publication, he's long since gone, but his publication in terms of what it is saying about the candidacy of Mr. Trump, and it is something that I think is interesting, to say the least. And one of the things that I know, and I'm not, you know, a lot of people disagree with me on this one, and they have the right to disagree. And I understand their frustration with Congress. I understand their frustration with Washington. But do we really want to have somebody in that position that A has never been in that position, you know, never sort of been in that position, a rookie, and number two, you know, doesn't, I guess, have the skill set that I would be looking for as a president of the United States? Don, I understand your position. I understand your frustration. I'm just not sure Donald Trump is the person that will end your frustration. I'm sorry I took your time, Bob, on this, but
no, that's fine.
Okay. Let's get back to the budget.
Okay.
So we talked about the provider tax and the fact that there is this provider tax that's been extended to dentists and to private practice doctors. Anything else in the budget? And I understand you've only had it 24 hours. And for the listeners, I don't care who's the governor. They tell you what they want you to hear. They don't tell you what you don't want to hear.
Right.
Is there anything in the budget that you've discovered that is also problematic?
No. I'm at a 35,000-foot level right now, and no, I haven't flipped enough pages. We will be getting that done, though, here on into this next week and the week after. And where it really comes in is when you start the testimony from the departments that are involved. And then you find out little bits and pieces that don't click and don't add up. And then maybe you can start putting something together. But it takes a number of weeks, actually, to start to accumulate that type of data. And you find out then places that you might go to save some money, or you might have to go to spend some more money.
What's the most, if you sort of had to describe, what's the most difficult part of putting a budget together, a state budget together?
It's like tying three pieces of rope together. It's odd because a third one never fits in, and it's clumsy, and it takes some real concentration and a long time to make everything work and fit together to make three pieces come together and tie up in a knot that means something. I don't know if that was a good analogy, but there's an old saying, you've got to know the answer before you ask the question.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very important sometimes, but impossible. So you have to ask enough questions that you think you know the answer, or you think you're coming close, so as you can eke some information out to move yourself forward on an issue.
You mentioned that Medicaid has been driving the deficits, both in the current fiscal year, which is FY16, but also in the new budget that the governor presented yesterday in FY17. Any thoughts on how you get that under control?
My only thought is not taxing yourself out of it anymore. However, that I believe that's out. I think we've gone the gamut on that for now. But to caps, put caps on. We did that back in, I don't think it was the Douglas administration, but it was back around the year 2000, in that area somewhere. We put caps on a few programs, I recall. I think we took them off later. Or some type of a limit. Or, if not caps, then you increase what you've got to have in order to qualify.
Mm-hmm.
There's two ways, but this building isn't really good at looking at those features.
One of the things that startled me, at least from newspaper accounts, is that eligibility checking has gone by the wayside. Now, my understanding, the administration has been picking back up, but that seems to be an issue in my mind if you don't check the eligibility.
Right. And I'm hearing more and more about that. I think it's necessary to start reviewing that. The problem with DCF, for instance, they don't have enough employees to do what they're doing now. So the minute you come up with that, then they want more employees. And so you have to have that conversation. But I think we need to go there. I think it needs to be a total in-depth review.
Let's go to some of the things that are swirling around that's outside of the Appropriations Committee, for example. Carbon tax. Are you for a carbon tax?
No. You knew that.
Well, I have to ask questions. That's my job. Marijuana. Where are you on legalizing marijuana?
I kicked that one around for a long time, but I finally concluded with myself here a few months ago that I can't support it. And, there's a number of reasons for that, the driving and under the influence and all that stuff. But, when push comes to shove and you want to wade through them all, I think the most important one to me is, what kind of a message is this sending to the kids? You get kids in 8th and 9th grade and we're saying, well, it's legal to smoke marijuana. Go ahead and do it. I believe probably alcohol to some degree. Marijuana are all first steps on up into higher usage of other drugs. For some, no, but for some, yes. I just think it's the wrong direction for us to go legally, and it's against the federal law. Mm-hmm. Now, what happens if another president comes in that decides he's going to chase the federal law around and comes into Vermont and Colorado and says, hey, guys, you guys have a big problem here? And I don't know what happens then, but it's just clumsy.
The Senate has voted to remove the caps of Act 46. What's your position on that?
Yeah, to some degree. And I think the House is coming up with a little bit of a plan.
The House plan would give it a little bit more room within the caps. Is that right?
Right, right. And I don't know the details on that. I just heard about it about an hour ago. But, I think we need to move some, but I've got to find a place where my taxpayers and my schools both can live with.
Right.
And that's hard.
The Senate is struggling with a ethics committee. They want to, the House has an ethics committee. The Senate is struggling with whether, how to put together an ethics committee, what they should be looking at and everything like that. Secretary of State Condos has recommended an ethics commission. Where do you lie in all this sort of stuff?
I think an ethics commission or committee, I think an ethics commission or committee would be a mistake, because I don't know where ethics begin and where they end. And I'm just not sure what it's going to cover and what the, I think it would depend on who's on that committee and commission as to what would be enveloped into a study on me or some other senator or representative for something he may have said, or is it something you have to do? And in the past case here in the Senate, the guy wasn't even proven guilty, and they expelled him. Doesn't matter what you think of that issue. You're innocent until proven guilty. So I think those guys can get carried away with themselves a little bit sometimes. We don't have a lot of problems in Vermont. I mean, this isn't New York or California.
The budget. Let's get back to the budget for a minute. You're going to be reviewing it starting real soon here, probably today. You'll start the budget process.
They're doing it.
They're doing it right now as they do it. How long will it take you to get to pass a budget out of the House?
It'll be the end of March.
Okay.
Mid-March to the end of, probably, I'm going to say the 20th.
And it's safe to assume that you're not going to support any new taxes from what I'm hearing you in that budget.
Well, at this point, no. No, I don't plan to.
We've been speaking with Representative Bob Helms from the Castleton-Fairhaven area. He now lives in Fairhaven after lifelong in Castleton. I thank you, Bob, for coming on this morning.
Mike, it's a pleasure. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much. Coming up, we'll talk about the impact of what the state is doing on business. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We have joining us on Open Mic this morning the Vermont representative for the National Federation of Independent Businesses, and that is Chris Jolin. Chris, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me today.
Well, thank you for being here. Who does your organization represent, and how do you represent their interests?
Well, our membership right now in Vermont is between 1,300 and 1,400 small businesses that span across Vermont. They range from mechanics, small retailers, small mom-and-pop shops, hair salons, anything. Mostly probably around 4 to 5 employees is the bulk of our membership. We represent them. We take ballots, and we ballot our membership on upcoming issues in the legislature that could have an effect on small businesses. We get their opinion on how it may affect them, do they support it, and based off of their polls, we then take a position on the legislation going through. We are very active in the legislature. I'm here every day. And we keep them updated on the progress of legislation, what the legislation is looking to do, where it might be going. We ask them to contact legislators or contact us with their concerns and bring them forth to the legislature for or against any legislation. So that is probably the bulk of what we do. We constantly keep them informed. And we're here to work for them, be the voice of small business, and do their work.
I want to go to the phone lines, and I suspect Jay has a comment from a previous guest, but I want to make sure that I get Jay on. He's been patient. He's been waiting.
Sure.
We've had a lot going on here. So, Jay from Chelsea, you're on Open Mic. Good morning, and I apologize, Jay. It's taken me so long to get to you.
No problem, Mike. Thank you for taking my call. How are you today?
Fine, thank you, sir.
Well, I'll get right to the point. Yes, I am a little disturbed to hear the last gentleman who you interviewed there. I don't know
Representative Helms.
Sometimes the information where they get from, but obviously they're not listening to WDEV, because there was a news report about how the National Academy of Sciences has done a study, and they found that there's no difference in the intellect of youthful marijuana smokers and non-smokers. I would also like to refer the listeners to two articles in the Valley News, one from Tuesday, February 10th, 2015, which was done by the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, that did a study on people who used marijuana and drove. And they found that there really, for the most part, there was no difference in their ability. And they were definitely safer than people who were drinking alcohol. The next article in the Valley News was on Sunday, November 8th, 2015. That's about the monthly revenue from marijuana sales in Colorado. They're estimating that they are going to bring in $76 million in 2014. I'd also like to say that William F. Buckley was, as you said, started the National Review, and he came out and endorsed the legalization of marijuana. And I think those are important for people to understand. And if we perhaps had more farmers in the State House who actually knew how to, that things actually grow. They don't just grow. They grow from the soil. And manufacturing has never come back, is going to come back. We shipped all the pollution into China. After Earth Day in 1970, Richard Nixon and Kissinger went to China. And the deal was, hey, listen, guys, we got a great deal from you. We'll ship all our pollution and manufacturing over there. All the people will think like, oh, you people are big polluters, but you send all the manufactured goods to us. So,
Jay, let me suggest this. So, this is an issue that I think we got to circle back on, which is the marijuana issue. And if you just would hold on for a week or so, we'll bring back a show on that issue in terms of marijuana, legalizing marijuana. I think it's an important enough issue. I think it's an important enough public policy issue. I'll get back to that. I do want to get back to Chris, and we're speaking with the Vermont representative for the National Federation of Independent Business, Chris Jolin. Chris, what, from your perspective, is the state moving in the right direction?
Me personally, I don't believe so. I don't know if
from your organization.
From organization, we're very troubled by the stances that the legislature has gone through. Obviously, we're still, most of the state is still trying to claw back from the Great Recession. There have been studies out there that have shown, I think there's two counties that have come back to pre-recession levels, which is Chinden and Franklin, and we're continuing to pile on regulation and new taxes onto small businesses, like minimum wage increases. Right now, they're discussing paid sick leave legislation, and it's adding on to the cost of doing business, any business burden for the business owners, and it's constantly making it harder for them to do business. Vermont is a very small state. rural state. I think most of the population lives near the borders of New Hampshire, New York, Massachusetts, and we're not immune to these regulations coming through because people are constantly moving out of state. They're doing business somewhere else. It's becoming harder for them to do business. And the legislature, as well as the governor, hasn't taken approach to slow down the burden on those small businesses. Every year there's some new regulation coming out. We're still dealing with the increase in minimum wage. It's now $9.60, I believe, continuing going to go up 40 cents and then 50 cents the year after. On top of that, we may be dealing with paid sick leave legislation and on top of other costs like employer assessment taxes that still hurt small businesses. And sometimes small businesses, they don't know what to do next. And it just seems like an onslaught of waves of regulation coming through the State House every year. And it's a very uncertain time for them.
Let's go to Bill in Barrie. Bill, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. You were talking about the tax on doctors and dentists, of course. And, of course, it's going to add a tax. It's going to raise money this year. But I believe there's another reason for this tax, and that is to change the scope of how the doctors operate. We right now have some competition with some doctors. Around here, some of the doctors are specialists, and the only specialists we have. Now, what the plan is, I think Sheldon's plan is to raise the money now, but in the future, to change the scenery so that more doctors, especially the new doctors that are graduating, aren't going to want to start their own businesses. They're going to go with the hospitals and such. So this is like a consolidation of schools. I'd like to know what your guests think about that.
Hey, thank you very much for your phone call. One of the things that you had mentioned, and it was in the governor's State of the State address, was the paid leave. In the budget address yesterday was the issue of this provider tax, expanding the provider tax to doctors, private practice doctors, mm-hmm. And dentists. What's your position on that?
I'm not prepared to take a stance on that. Yesterday that was the first thing that was brought to my attention. I haven't heard of that until yesterday, so I think I'll have to look into that a little further to see if we take a position. I'm not sure how much of a burden that will be on small businesses, small practices. It will be something we take a close look at, but I'm not really prepared to.
So generally, the State of the State address and the budget address is where the governor sort of lays out his vision for mm-hmm. Vermont, lays out his vision for Vermont, and then talks about how he's going to pay for it. Generally, what was your impression of both of those speeches?
The State of the State, it was a lot of praising past accomplishments, whether if you believe they're accomplishments or not. The budget address, it was less spending, increased spending, but the state is still not staying within its means of revenue when it's not as bad as it's been the past few years, with an increase of 5% or more on spending, but we're still above 3.5% spending when the revenue is coming in on a lot less. The state is still not operating within its means, and it's historically been small businesses that have had to bail the government out of this. And it's really stretching the flexibility of small businesses to be able to pick up the tab on this. And until the government reins in its spending, starts living within its means, it's going to continue to spill over into small businesses. Businesses can't pay more than what they take in. They have a budget that they have to stay within. They can't spend without that or spend above that. Why should the government be spending above that? It's not a good business model, and it's going to continue to be hard for businesses the more we spend. And that's been the biggest trend with this governor and this legislature through the budget over the last few years, and including going into this year.
What's your number one issue?
Number one issue.
Our reception.
Well, we we are dealing with a multitude of issues right now. Currently, they're discussing paid leave downstairs in Senate Economics Committee. We've been following that closely, but the budget is still probably the biggest issue facing the state. When the state budget continues to have a shortfall in the tens of millions, if not more, it's a serious problem for the state. It evolves into more taxes, more regulations, more fees that fall on the business owners. So all of it, it's still a hard strain on these Vermont business owners. And all in all, the spending is probably what will continue to hurt them the most, especially with the continued regulations coming out every year.
Are there specific regulations? You talked about paid sick leave, mm-hmm. and I get that. Are there other specific regulations that, if you had a magic wand, that you would repeal?
Probably the employer assessment tax, which employers are on the hook to pay a fee for any employees that they do not cover, and even if they're covered under.
And we're talking health care.
Talking health care, yes.
Right.
And even if the employer is able to and wishes to cover them, and they refuse, if the employee chooses to be covered under Medicaid or go through the healthcare exchange, they still have to pay that fee, that quarterly fee, which is tiered per employment. That costs them hundreds and hundreds of dollars each year per employee. So that's really a burden that shouldn't be on the employer.
I'm just out of curiosity, Chris, what is the difference between your organization and, let's say, the chambers?
It's a good question. The chambers, like them, you pay for membership. But the difference in NFIB, we don't have a board of directors like the chambers does. They don't base their positions off the board and their decision. We are, everyone is one vote. Every business is one vote. Doesn't matter if they're a business of 2 employees or 50 employees or 100 employees. We ballot them. Their vote means the same as anyone bigger or anyone smaller, and we go off of that. We really just take the opinion of our membership, which is usually pretty consistent on one side or the other. So that's probably the biggest.
Does it line up with it? Usually, does it line up with the agenda, the same agenda as the chambers, or different?
I'd say historically, probably along the lines, maybe some differences. Another difference is you have the chambers, you have regional chambers, you have city chambers, state chambers, national chambers. They all require separate membership. If you're a business in Rutland, you have to pay a fee for membership for state chamber as well as Rutland chamber, any county chamber, NFIB. It's one-time membership that gives you state and federal. You are kept up to date, and you also have the ballot power at both levels. Doesn't cost you anything different, and that's another probably big difference from the chambers.
We've talked mostly about fiscal issues. I mean, the paid sick leave is a fiscal issue.
Sure.
That environmental issues at the top of your agenda as well?
I'd have to look back to see if we've ever done anything. It depends if it's really going to affect businesses, or if we feel it'll affect businesses, then we will pull it. Mainly, it ends up being fiscal issues, because fiscal issues are the part of small business. That's where businesses come from and stem from. So mainly, it's mostly fiscal issues. We don't dive too much into social issues as well. It's anything that we believe will be a strain on small business or be a burden on them, we'll look into, pull it, and get their perspective on it.
For example, I'm just using this example. If the legislature, and they're not this year, but I've heard it in the past, if, for example, the legislature wanted to expand the sales tax to services, that would be something you would pull?
Yes.
Okay.
More than likely.
And once you get these results, how do you go about changing opinions here?
Changing what opinions?
Changing opinions of legislators that have different opinions of your members.
well, we bring, at the repolling, we have our results. We bring them to the legislators. When they take up the bill, we show them this is mostly what our membership thinks. X percent believes that we don't need this. And any comments, any people that we'd like to bring in. We've had plenty members come in, testify on behalf for themselves, their businesses, for or against any bill that is important to them.
Let me ask you this. You've mentioned this a couple of times, so I'm gathering it's a huge issue for your constituency, mm-hmm. paid sick leave.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to legislators about paid sick leave?
Well, yesterday we, NFIB testified in committee on it. Paid sick leave, we believe in benefits of that sort, but it should be left to the relationship of the employee and the employer. These continued mandates no longer make it a benefit, and it increases the cost. If employees can afford this, or if employers can afford this, they will do it. I believe 86% of our polled businesses said that they do offer some form of paid leave that can be used as sick time. I believe another 46% said that they do offer specific paid sick time. So it's really a solution in search of a problem. It's a small businesses that may not support this, and they may have a workforce that doesn't need it as well. So it should really be left up to the employer and the employee. The benefits are usually provided for them. It's an incentive for these business owners to attract good workers and to retain their good workers.
What's the result? I mean, you have a governor that has come out in support of it. It seems like it has supportive leadership here in both the House and the Senate. What's your sort of, if you're reading the tea leaves, what's going to happen with this bill?
It's hard to say. They're currently discussing it downstairs as we speak. They're looking for some compromises. I know some other organizations have discussed small business exemption, full-time student exemption, pause in implementing it, all sorts of things, and they're discussing that currently. I don't know if they'll come out with a bill today in committee or if it'll be next week.
Hey, Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for bringing us
your opinion on various things that are happening at the State House. We've been speaking with Vermont Representative for the National Federation of Independent Business, Chris Jolin. I want to thank our guests today on Open Mic, David Sharp, Chair of the House Education Committee, Ann Cummings, Chair of the Senate Education Committee, Jane Kitchell, the Chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, Bob Helms of the House Appropriation Committee, and, of course, Chris Jolin, who I just had talked with. This is Open Mic on WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. Hester Fuller will be in on Monday. I'm Mike Smith, and we'll tack again on Tuesday from the Farm Show in Essex Junction.